Hi, everybody, and welcome for joining us today. We're here to talk more about hybrid cloud, and today we're joined with Brad Anderson and Mark Rusinovich. Thanks for joining us today on another fantastic day here in Seattle with the bright blue skies.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys. So one of the things that has really kept me attracted always to IT is ultimately the only constant is change. Mm-hmm. There's always something new. There's always something that we're thinking about differently. And one of those things is always upgrades, right? You're always looking at upgrades of your environment and what that means. With the onset here of Windows Server 2003 coming to end of service, it's great to just talk through a little bit about how people should handle that.
Yep.
So we know everybody has a Windows Server 2003 in the corner. Maybe their facility guy is running his swipe card system on there, and I can't get rid of it. Don't touch it. You know, what's going to happen? Nobody can get in the building for weeks if that happens. So let's walk through a couple different scenarios here real quick. So one, let's kind of talk first about where you were and what was happening in 2003. So where were you then? What were you doing? And ultimately, let's kind of talk about how things have changed.
2003, I was actually just joining Microsoft. I joined Microsoft in May of 2003.
Yep.
You know, and it's funny, I think about technology and, you know, I actually had 2002 to 2003, that transition for me. I had my first Windows mobile phone.
Amazing.
It was made by Siemens, this
SX56.
Yeah. And I actually had, you know, for those of you who remember this right here, this is the compact iPad.
Yep.
I love this device.
It's awesome.
You know, color screen, you know, great PDA. I upgraded from my Palm 3 to this. So that's what I remember of 2003. And I remember moving to Seattle,
sure,
getting my first Windows phone, retiring my compact iPad.
So as we're kind of showing off our history here, we got a little museums in our back pockets here.
Yeah.
Same thing, right? And it's amazing how...
made a lot of money, right?
What do you do with that?
Yeah,
what do you do?
Beam me up.
How do you text on that?
Yeah, how do you text? How do you browse the web? How do you get your email on that, right?
Yeah. You're probably impressed with the size of the screen on that.
Yeah, it is actually pretty decent.
But
so I think two lines right there. Yeah.
The interesting part, though, things have come a long way, right? That was a long time ago.
11
and
years
it's
ago.
Amazing how much has changed. So, I mean, sure, the technology is still inside the data center. It's still running. It's oftentimes probably tied to the application. So let's just start there. You know, everybody has it. There's no kind of hiding it. What are some of the top reasons you really say, let's kind of pull the trigger here and start to upgrade? And let's kind of maybe take that application kind of viewpoint first. So if I've got an application on there, it's running on an older operating system. Mark, maybe you can start. What are some things I should start to think through? 2003 is coming to end of service. What are some options that I should start to consider as upgrade options from this point?
Well, one of the things that we've talked about before in the series is if you're going to make a move, now's the time to consider a move to the cloud.
Got it.
And whether that's a hosted cloud or a public cloud like Azure, but to consider getting it off of your own infrastructure and not refreshing that server that this thing is sitting on anymore, just letting it go at this point in time. So that's one option to consider, is modernizing in that fashion. Another one is, of course, if you're going to move to a new operating system underneath Server 2012 on top of Hyper-V and System Center to manage it and get that thing under control and get it modernized in terms of you understanding what that what application's doing, what the operating system's doing it, managing that operating system, making sure that you've got the app on the most secure operating system. I mean, if you look at Server 2003, the number of security innovations alone, there's
a little
probably
different, right?
Yeah, there's probably two dozen that I can think of that have gone into the Windows operating system in releases since Server 2003 that you're just not getting that kind of protection. So if it's that mission critical, an app you probably want it to be sitting on a secure box and not being compromised in some other way, and then going down out of your control.
Right.
So that's a key consideration right there.
That makes sense. So let's also talk about, there's probably been a lot of Windows Server 2003 virtualized, right? I mean, inside the data center that, hey, it's been sitting on not only an old piece, it's an older operating system, but it's also sitting on some aged hardware. So a lot of times they've done a P2V or physical to virtual and virtualized a little bit. Chances are, or in many cases, it may not end up on a Microsoft platform. So talk through, Brad, a little bit about some opportunity there. If I have a 2003 server running on a virtualized platform that's not Microsoft, and ways that I may be thinking through that.
Yeah, so you know, we talk about Windows Server 2003, and it's far more prevalent than the one in the corner doing the,
really
the security
is. It really
system.
Is.
You know, 40%. You know, a lot of the base is going to be moving. You know, over the next 12 months as we look towards that end of service. And so you mentioned virtualization. If you're virtualized, you know, heavily on 2003, I'll guarantee you're on VMware because you know that's where VMware's largest base is at. And so I think as you're, so the first thing, so we step back even, I think about what else do we have in our lives that we use day in and day out in business that's 11 years old?
Not many things.
Yeah, you know, I mean, how many new phones have you got? How many different, you know, applications
monthly
have been deployed?
Exactly.
And so, you know, the first thing, I just reading what Mark said, you know, if you're still on 2003, I mean, you're using technology that there's been literally 6 releases of the server operating since then.
Right.
You've had 2003 R2, 8 R2, 12 R2, 5.
Yep.
Okay, every single one of those advancing the technology forward in the networking, in storage, in compute, in security, in scalability. And so it's, I mean, literally, it is 10 years in the technology industry is like, you know, a millennium.
That's crazy.
Exactly. So as you think about how you modernize now, and I think as you upgrade from 2003, you should really step back and say, what is our strategy to move into a modern computing, a modern data center?
Yeah.
So let's modernize the data center.
Sure.
So, you know, I think as most organizations, especially if they're heavily virtualized, sit down and actually work through the math.
Yeah.
You know, you already own the licenses for Windows Server 2012.
Sure.
You're paying VMware an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
You can upgrade to a new version of the operating system, you know, get that deployed, Server 2012 R2, and for less money than you're paying VMware, attach that to the cloud and do disaster recovery, backup, all these other capabilities that allow you to move into a hybrid kind of a cloud computing environment, delivering capabilities that you've never done before.
Right.
Because, you know, as you think about virtualization, it's just built into Windows Server, it's not a separate SKU.
Right.
And so as you think about, as you modernize your data center, as you upgrade from Server 2003, think about how you move into a hybrid computing kind of a model, taking advantage of things like backup, disaster recovery. And I think you can do it for what you're paying right now as you shift your expand from VMware to other places.
Yeah, I mean, just think about the capabilities that are available today that weren't even imaginable then, right?
Yeah.
Nobody talked about consuming from the cloud. In 2003, when you deployed, you probably ordered a server. You've deployed it with some CDs, again, Mark, right? You're kind of out there doing it. And now there's ways that you can better manage that pieces, as you mentioned before. There's ways that I can roll it into my overall, what is my private cloud scenario, or what is my kind of external adoption scenario as well. How about, Mark, maybe from an application standpoint, are there Microsoft applications? Maybe I'm going to guess if I'm Windows Server 2003, I may have SQL Server 2005 on there. So is this an opportunity too, not to just look at the server operating system, but also those Microsoft applications that may be sitting on top of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes hand in hand with the same discussion we had about the operating system, the number of releases that each of our server back office products have gone through since that same time, and the innovation in there, SQL Server being a great example. The scalability, the performance, the security of SQL Server, same thing applies there. So absolutely, it's time to reevaluate the whole thing. Take the app and modernize the app while you're modernizing the infrastructure it's running on. Absolutely. It's kind of irresponsible not to think of doing it at the same time.
That's a good point.
Right? I mean, to defer that and leave that on ancient technology, which is going to end of life, you know, it's just following the same train towards that. So definitely it's the time to take a look at that.
So, Brad, what does the end of support for 2003 really mean for Microsoft?
Yeah, you know, so we have a really well-defined, and I think one of the industry's best support life cycles.
Yeah.
So when we release a new product, we talk about 5 full years of full mainstream support where we deliver all kinds of updates. The second 5 years of that, we continue to deliver security updates. You know, so we've clearly articulated it. And as we talk about end of support, that literally is coming to the end of that time when we stop delivering security updates. We'll continue to deliver our anti-malware for one more year after that, but we stop delivering updates of any kind the operating system when we hit the end of support date.
Sure. Mark, if I'm inside an IT organization and my manager comes to me and say, hey, what do we have for 2003 and what our plans are, what kind of advice would you have for people listening there?
We're going to upgrade.
Yeah, I am going to upgrade. I'm not going to sit on a liability is actually what I don't want to do, because that's what that becomes, is a liability. From a support perspective, just the support that Brad's been talking about, but the security liability that I've got on hand at this point is pretty big. I mean, the reason ostensibly that I haven't touched this thing is because it's sitting there reliably. I don't want to touch it because that thing is so critical to some aspect of the operation of my business. Now what's going to happen is this thing is sitting there wide open when it comes out to security vulnerabilities that get discovered by the hackers. That this thing now becomes that liability. Like, how do I sleep at night wondering if that thing is getting hacked?
Right.
And now it... it's not just a mission critical asset that I got to protect, but now this thing could be a launching pad into the rest of my network.
That's what I was just thinking, right? It could be basically an open door into everything else. So an IT pro may think, you know what, I've got this application on there, it's running good, everything's fine, don't worry about it. But to your point, that could be a door into something else.
Yeah, it's just time
about
the
scary part. All right, so we just talked to a bunch of partners at Worldwide Partner Conference. This seems like it's a pretty good opportunity for them. What kind of things are you hearing, and what kind of opportunity does it present for them to go into their customers?
Yeah, you know, so these partners that are just have always been so critical to Microsoft's strategy, I would argue this is the single largest opportunity for them over the next 12 months, because you're going to have such a large number of customers moving such a large number of operating systems up to 2012. Sure. You know, so I think that you can go in, our partners, as this trusted advisor, which they are to their customers, and say, listen, let's step back, let's formulate what your modern data center strategy should be, and then let's upgrade you to a modern operating system, you know, or a modern version in 2012, get you connected up to a hybrid model. And again, I think that this can be done in a way that is revenue or is cost neutral to the customer, but puts them into a much richer environment, much richer capabilities, by stepping back and just reevaluating the strategy.
Yeah, so, and I assume even as these partners are having that conversation, it's an opportunity to talk to them about alternative consumption models too as well, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so possibly up to Azure or up to even a service provider that's running those services.
Yeah, that's right. And actually the service provider, I mean, one of the things that you're hearing at WWPC is us talking more about fleshing out our management story. And everything that we do at this point and for some time now has been focused on consistency across the three, what they call, we call the three clouds, the public, the hoster, the on-premises clouds. So everything you look at, all these investments in dynamic, automated application management, deployment, developer, lifecycle, all of that is, we're taking to all three of those clouds. Yeah. So anybody investing in us is getting that. You saw the first step in that with the Windows Azure Pack, the ability to deploy and manage websites and VMs in a way through a consistent interface, portal experience that we've got up in the public cloud. That's just getting richer and deeper every month that goes by, and us kind of announcements like you saw at WWPC this week.
Yeah, for most of these customers, as they're going to upgrade from 2003, it's also going to be coupled with an upgrade of the hardware.
That's so true.
You know, so good is point. It 10, 12, 15 million servers will be upgraded over the next, you know, year? In many of those cases, I think it's the right conversation, the appropriate conversation to say, do we want to have these hosted in our data centers, or would we rather have some of these hosted with a service provider or in a public cloud? But think broadly about the options available to you. I think, and this is where I think Microsoft just offers a level of flexibility and no lock-in that others in the industry just do not. Because you truly do have that public-private hosted model that you can go into and then move about at your own at what makes sense to you.
So we talked a lot about where you're moving your next kind of move from when you're modernizing your data center. Yep. So this whole idea about taking your applications on-premise, embracing the cloud, kind of modernizing your approach there. What are some things that you can advise your customers to give them confidence that the cloud is really the right place to land when they're looking at that 2003 end of support?
Well, we've talked a lot about the automation that we've put it driven into our cloud.
Sure.
We can't get to the scale of millions of servers, which is the scale that we're operating at now, without heavily automating everything.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that's unique about Microsoft as a partner when it comes to looking at migrating from the cloud, on-premises to the cloud, or even just continuing to invest in on-premises infrastructure, but know that you've got somebody that's going to be able to take you to the cloud, is that we have this first party equals third party mantra within Microsoft and within our cloud development, which says that every innovation that we make when it comes to automation, application development, management, that all of that is not secret sauce for us to keep, but all of that is with an eye to making it available to our customers. Ideally, our customers to even take to their own environments, whether that be a hoster or back to their own data centers. And so there's none of the other cloud providers have that same philosophy. It's clear, like, we don't know what kind of software Google's using to operate their data center. Same thing with Amazon, but we're sharing all of that software and all of that learning back with our customers. We're building out, like I said, millions of servers, thousands of servers, constantly rolling out into our data centers. And what we've done is created optimized server SKUs. You know, this is one of the things that we've learned as we've moved into this space is that when we used to buy servers from OEMs, like many of our customers do, they come with CD drives that we don't use in the cloud. They come with blinky lights on the disks that we don't use in the cloud. Not just unnecessary, but actually can hurt availability. We've had cases where capacitors on the blinky lights have had flaws in them and actually caused servers to fail.
Sure.
And so that makes you step back and go, if you're small scale, you might not notice that. There's a few servers that are bad, but when you have tens of thousands of these things deployed and that starts to cause a problem, you start to say, why the heck do we have blinky lights on our disk?
So give us the servers without blinky lights.
So you get rid of them. The pictures of the data center aren't as cool, but the availability is much better. And then we drive that back into Open Compute. So we've taken that server reference design that we've got and made that public, opened it up, make it open source.
The design, and the blueprints. Yeah. I mean, we published everything
and, to Open Compute. And what we want to do is, that's the design that we're buying towards. That will create the supply chain efficiency for those parts that are able, that servers are created from. Sure. So now if you want to create servers at the lowest cost in your own data center, you can go to an OEM that's building to that reference design. They're going to take advantage of that scale that we're driving into the whole ecosystem.
Sure.
To get the best prices.
Yeah, and that strategy is we want to be able to deliver customers the ability to use the exact same things that we use in our data centers and their data centers. So working with OEMs, they'll literally be able to buy the same service that we use in our data centers.
It makes sense. And then, Brad, I've heard you say a lot of times the things that Azure has done, for example, the number of hosts there, everything that's happening there, and that's impressive, right? I mean, it's not just your kind of grandfather's data center or whatever you want to call it, but maybe run through a little bit of kind of some of the success or learnings you've had there, and some of those pieces would be great.
Yeah, and I've said this before, but Microsoft truly is the only global public cloud provider operating at that global scale that is committed to and demonstrated the ability to take everything that we're learning and deliver to customers to use in their data centers, whether that's private cloud or a hosted cloud. One of the things that we have focused a lot on for us in Azure is our ability to tightly manage our supply chain is actually one of the most impactful pieces of the business.
Yeah.
And so, if you think about what's world class in managing your supply chain, world class is from the time that you signal to your hardware part that you need hardware, it arrives in your dock within 30 days, and then it's live supporting workloads in 2.
Yeah.
So order to dock 30 days, dock to live 2.
Yep.
I think if most organizations ask themselves the question, are they anywhere near that? If we're honest, most will say no.
I totally agree.
But that's the goal, that's what we're driving to inside of Azure, and our intent is to deliver that exact same capability through Windows Server, through System Center, through these hardware partners that we're working with, so customers can't have that. Order to dock 30 days, dock to live 2 days or less. That's one wonderful example. One of the things that we have learned through operating the public cloud is we can actually take our code that we're working on, put it up in the public cloud, try it, prove it, battle hardened, then bring it on premises. And when it comes on premises, it's actually ready to go.
Yeah, sure.
And so it actually has accelerated our overall capacity, our capability to deliver new capabilities, because we prove it in Azure and then deliver it on premise. And in most cases, it actually is common code.
Sure.
So through the Windows Azure Pack, you have things like the portal. You have things like high-density websites, service bus.
Sure.
Literally the same exact bits that run inside of Azure that also can now run in your private cloud or in a public cloud, and it's ready, and it'll run at the kind of scale that we have in Azure.
Yeah, Mark, and that's a little bit different than what many people may be used to, where if I'm going to rev my hardware, I'm going to rev software, it may be months or years between doing that. But when you adopt that model, I mean, updates come much more frequently, don't they?
Yeah, and the cloud we ship. So every service has a different cadence depending on what they're doing, but many are shipping every day.
Continually.
There's some that are actually multiple times a day. I mean, the portal is shipping multiple times a day.
Amazing.
And so that allows us to do a few things. One is to try things out, to experiment. Okay. So experimentation becomes a key part of what we're doing now in Azure. And having the scale and having that agility of engineering systems to be able to push something out, see how it works, learn from that, come back, either go in a different direction or go deeper into that direction with some course correction. And then, as Brad said, what we do is snap off that and make that available to our customers, and it's already gone through that experimentation, so you're not seeing the result. You're not in the mid-experimentation, you're seeing the results of the Darwinian good paths.
In the old days, the analysts used to say, hey, wait for Service Pack 1 from Microsoft.
Oh my goodness, so, yeah.
You don't have to do that, because by the time we deliver this capability through Windows Server, it's already been proven in Azure. It's ready to go.
Makes sense. One of the interesting topics we always get into is, you're using infrastructure as a service, but what are you using it for? So let me go through the reasons. It's ultimately people we say are using it as backup and archive, and disaster recovery follows those top two reasons. Mark, do you see the customers that are talking to you kind of bring that same approach to your plate?
Definitely. One of the things that we do at Microsoft is we go to these executive briefing center and meet with customers.
Yeah.
And I've heard this more than once now. A large customer comes in, one that has multiple data centers, and they say, if I went back to our CEO and I said I want to build another data center, I'd be fired.
Sure, it's a great point.
And so, but they've got a whole bunch of existing assets. Sure. And so when it comes to DR for the all those apps that they are deploying into that infrastructure,
sure,
they can't go and say, I want to create another data center as the secondary for this.
Sure.
So the logical answer then is to look at the cloud as the secondary for these new types of apps.
Yeah.
And so that's clearly a direction where people are going to get started. Need to make you know, the return on investment, whatever, the 10 years out of my data center and the 3 years out of the hardware, make use of that, but I'm not going to build another one.
Right.
Right.
And so one thing that happens is that they artificially constrain actually what applications are being protected.
Right.
It's only the most mission critical, and so you actually don't deliver that level of service across the board. So I think it is cost, but then ultimately translates in just a poor quality experience for the users.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I understand, based on those top two reasons, you guys have made a recent acquisition there to help customers out further.
Yeah, you know, so we just announced the acquisition of an organization called InMaj.
Yep.
And what InMaj, what we found as we were, you know, looking at the industry is they have this wonderful backup and disaster recovery that covers physical and virtual instances. Virtual being Hyper-V and VMware, and it does it for Windows and for Linux. So literally, you know, using this capability, you can now provide a backup and disaster recovery solution at a very affordable price for all of your OS instances, whether they're physical, whether they're virtual, whether they're Windows, whether they're Linux, whether they're Hyper-V, whether they're VMware. And as we bring this in, we'll also enable that all up to Azure, and you'll have this wonderful solution across the board for every one of your OS instances. We're very, very excited about this one.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've really upped the business continuity that you're able to offer to customers by being able to really rethink how they're protecting those virtual machines and workloads, and being able to still take advantage of that cloud and modernize what they're doing.
Yeah, I think one of the key things here is we've been talking about Windows Server 2003 is, as organizations are thinking about moving to this modern data center.
That's a great example, right?
Yeah, you know, take your investments and think about how you move up to 2012, how you move to thinking about the cloud as a tier, and start to think about how you provide that disaster recovery across the board, not just for your small sliver.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear. And we see that as well, right? We see people looking at infrastructure service, and a lot of times it reminds me a little bit of virtualization. So at the beginning, what was it? It was IT-owned workloads, test and dev, but more and more people looking at it as another tier as they build out their applications. Yeah. As well.
And then once they get comfortable with it, they start moving more in.
They do, anywhere it makes sense. How about as far as modern applications go? So I'm kind of thinking through a little bit, putting my IT hat back on. And if I have a 2003 machine running, I probably have an older application, as we were saying earlier. Is that an option to actually, or one of those tipping points where I can start to look at, now I can think about modernizing that application, potentially looking at even different development platform?
Yeah, and I think that there's different ways that people can do that.
Yep.
I see there's kinds of applications that people are going to lift and shift, you know, keep just sit there, it's going to keep running, I don't want to invest in it. But those ones that are actually delivering business value, I might want to make more efficient, make more manageable, and start to modernize it. And you can do that in pieces. You don't have to do the whole thing at once.
Sure.
So the canonical SOA three-tier application, SQL on the back end, web on the front end, and work business logic in the middle tier, you could take that front end, which is actually the most stateless. Yep. It's really they're IaaS because really there was no option other than IaaS.
Sure.
So each one of those is unique and I'm managing those individually. When you go to a cloud like Azure, which has PaaS, you can take those front ends and make those PaaS, make those front ends stateless and make them scale out. And now your management burden, your patching, your deployment, your configuration drift goes away, you get scaling, you get high availability, you get all of that with very simply. And in fact, we show, it's kind of a simplistic case, but you can go into Visual Studio, you can take a web application, and then you can right click and say, create a cloud project from it, and deploy it up into Azure, an Azure website if you want to. So that's one way to start. The same thing on the back end, if you look SQL Server, SQL Azure, same API. So that might be a place, depending on the requirements of the back end, to modernize that. And then the middle tier, a lot of times takes a little more work, but that might be, you know, something you leave alone, that might be something that you want to continue investing in. And then the greenfield applications, those new ones, right? All the new line of business applications. Yep. I mean, the cloud is not going to stop businesses from wanting to create thousands of applications for each individual business workflow and business scenario, customer-facing ones, internal-facing ones. And so if you're going to go build something new, definitely start with something modern. Don't, you know, that's easy to manage, easy to scale, get high availability, get backup out of it very easily. So that's what we recommend our customers, and that's what really resonates with them. That's why they want to go with somebody that not only knows how to handle their existing stuff, but is able to take them forward as well.
I mean, it's ultimately a good trigger point, right? I mean, it's not, oh my goodness, it's going away, and I've got to uplift my whole OS. It's really a trigger point for other things that are happening inside of IT as well.
Yeah, that's right.
How about just, let's talk about economics for a second. So we talked about, and you mentioned a few good examples about, hey, they already own Windows Server 2012 licensing.
Yeah.
But really, there's a little bit of a shift in some people's minds that if I'm not advanced and I've just done some virtualization and I'm kind of figuring out what to do, there is a shift between, hey, there's this capital investment I'm making, as opposed to, hey, I'm paying for things a little bit differently, right? Yeah. I'm paying for things on a monthly basis. And there's always stories about there as, oh, my developers went home over the weekend, the next thing we showed up on Monday and we had a $50,000 bill, what happened? So give me, as somebody, let's kind of talk about that. Is that a fear that an IT pro should have as they're taking 2003 and looking at cloud as a potential landing platform for it?
I can start. Yeah. You know, this fear of, you know, coming back on the weekend and the $50,000.
You've heard it, right?
Yes, it's not real. You know, so inside of Azure, you actually can put in limits, you know, so you can auto scale, but you can actually put in limits. And a bunch of the work that we've done over the years is to make it very clear, you know, here's what it's going to cost and give you an idea of what it would cost you, you know, for a week, for a month. Exactly.
Okay, sure.
But you can put limits in, you know, and so, you know, I think the fear is, you know, if all of a sudden it starts auto scale, it's kind of auto scale infinitely. You just put a limit on it.
Yeah.
Let me talk a little bit about, you know, one of the things that I see many organizations kind of falling into in a place where the cloud can help. Now, if you think about the cloud as a tier of your data center, as an extension of your data center, it becomes your overdraft.
Yeah.
And, you know, most organizations, when they step back and they're designing their capacity, you'll always design for peak, and then you'll like go 50% above that.
I hope that's enough.
Yeah, but the reality is you know, you design for peak, and reality, most of these servers run at 10 to 12, 14% utilization. And so you've spent a lot of CapEx, you're doing a lot of power, a lot of cooling, and it's just not necessary. Well, why not think about the cloud as your tier for you to be able to do your overdraft into? So right-size your investment on-premises and then leverage the public cloud or a service provider for those moments when you have to scale out, whether that's, you know, Black Friday through Cyber Monday if you're retail, you know, it's April if you're in taxes, you know, it's the end of the quarter when you're doing your tax reports. Leverage the cloud, and where you might be only spending hundreds of dollars for the capacity that you need for that peak period, rather than going out and spending thousands, hundreds of thousands to build out, you know, for what your peak capacity could be. It's just wise, it's economical. But I think the key thing to think about here is just don't think about it in terms of economics, think about it in terms of agility.
Sure.
You know, if you need more capacity, it's there on demand. You don't have to go through a supply chain, you don't have to worry about those types of aspects. Yep. You can get capacity on demand for what the business needs.
Mark, do you see that? Do you see people still concerned about that and asking you those questions?
The sticker shock, the cloud shock that they get. Yeah, people still, it's a lot less, actually, a few years ago. I mean, the thing is, when people were going to the cloud, they didn't understand the cloud billing model. They start to get familiar with that. That's why I recommend, actually, one of the best places to start if you're going to start with the cloud is DevTest. And actually, DevTest really highlights the agility. If you look at the DevTest on premises with traditional IT infrastructure, marketing department wants to create a line of business application, a customer-facing app, for example.
Sure.
They traditionally have had to go to IT, tell them exactly what they want.
Sure.
IT maybe goes and procures a few servers. That takes a month. Then they get the operating system on there, the network configured properly, the patching on it, the application. And 60 days, typically, is what we hear to get that up and running, just for DevTest.
Sure.
And so, what the cloud enables is while you're doing that for maybe your production, so you say that my production site, I want to provision it, procure it on, using my existing infrastructure that way, my developers can go right to the cloud and start to dev test right there. So when that stuff shows up, the app's ready to go and I drop it back on premises. Yeah. While I'm doing that, there's low risk, I don't have production data up there, so security issues are minimal. I don't have reliability questions because it's dev test. Yeah. So it's a place to just get comfortable. Like, what is the cloud? What is the availability of the cloud? What is the security of the cloud? How do I connect to the cloud? How do I move stuff back and forth? All of that, plus take advantage of the agility at the same time. So it's not like you're doing something out of your way.
Sure.
You're actually getting benefit out of it and learning at the same time.
Makes sense. So I think really what I heard is the people listening get a lot of homework to do, right?
Yeah.
They've got a lot of great things to look at. With 2003, it's not the end of the world, it's just the end of support.
Yeah.
And what that does is gives them opportunities, new trigger points for a modern approach to what they've already been doing. They may make some great progress on-premise kind of server virtualization, managing things better, but this is an opportunity to even open up the doors more from a cloud consumption model, what Microsoft's doing there as well. You've mentioned some great examples of ways that Microsoft has scaled to kind of help people, way that you've talked about the economic piece. We talk about even really devaluing risk as well inside that environment. So I think we've got a lot of nice things to go. And when we look at 2003, it's about modernizing that data center, potentially even modernizing applications. Thank you guys very much for taking the time out. Great discussion. I think people now are excited to get through that end of support issue.
Thank you.
Thanks guys.
Thanks, Brett.
Good seeing you, Mark.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today for the live question and answer section of this webcast. Brad and Mark are here, so guys, thanks for sticking around and taking some questions. So one of the first questions that we got here today was kind of looking at the end of support for Windows Server 2003. Tell us a little bit, Brad, about the conversations you've been having with customers. We get a lot of customers that come here to Redmond, and then you travel a lot as well and talk to customers out in the field. What's some of the feedback that you've been getting from them about the end of support and how and how you've been telling people they can proactively address this?
Yeah, you know, the funniest thing is when I meet with individuals here in Redmond, it's generally in these executive briefing sessions, you know, where senior leaders from my company will come in and talk with us. And I'll tell you, the first thing that's most interesting is how often I'm in a conversation and the senior leaders inside of a company don't realize how much 2003 they still have in their data centers. And so it's literally these conversations about, well, hey, you know, Windows Server 2003 has end of service coming up here, you know, in less than a year. And you know, whether it's a CIO or someone say, well, hey, it's a good thing we don't have very much of that. And the kind of like the VP of infrastructure will kind of like, well, you know, actually we've got quite a bit of it. Let's give you a couple of data points you may find interesting. You know, in terms of the percentage of the base that is still on 2003, it's significant. We think that there's about 15 million actual physical boxes that are hosting 2003 and many, many times more than that, the number of instances of 2003 that are still running around the world. And I think the most interesting thing that I see people doing is as they're looking at their upgrade from 2003 to 2012, it really is one of those conversations where they step back and they say, okay, so listen, we're going to do this upgrade. How do we want to modernize our data center? How do we want to move into a modern kind of a world as we migrate from 2003? So it's wonderful because I see organizations moving to 2012. As they move to 2012, they're also able to take advantage of a number of these hybrid cloud scenarios that we've been talking about. You know, we just were looking at some research from Forrester, and that research talked about the fact that, you know, hey, 70% of organizations that were queried in this said they were using backup to the cloud as a workload. 75% are saying they're using disaster recovery. And so what I tell people is, you know, listen, you're going to go from 2003 to 2012. You're obviously going to be able to consolidate, you know, significantly the number of OS instances you have running on a single server. If you've already virtualized, chances are you're running on VMware since we didn't support 2003 with Hyper-V. And so it's a chance to basically look at how you modernize your data center, go to 2012. As you go to 2012, also move to Hyper-V, take the money that you save from no longer having to pay the exorbitant prices to VMware, and embrace other things like these cloud services. And so, you know, what I recommend to people is for the same amount of money that you're spending today in 2003, you can move to the modern world in 2012, take advantage of hybrid scenarios, provide disaster recovery backup automatically to the cloud for the same price that you're paying today in your 2003 world without those capabilities. So I think it's a chance to save money, to enhance the capabilities, to provide DR and HA for a greater percentage of your overall OS instances and applications. And then what we actually see is as customers are moving from 2003 to 2012, the percentage of them that are also taking that as the time when they also literally move from VMware to Hyper-V is incredibly high. And that's one of the most exciting things that I personally see in the transition.
Now, this is something of an architecture question, Mark. The question here is, where are these clouds located, and is there some type of blueprint for the public cloud?
Interesting question. Where are they located? Well, they're in the cloud.
Yeah. They're everywhere.
They're
everywhere.
Physical locations. So this is one of the points I think where we're leading, because we have the largest cloud footprint of any cloud provider in the world when it comes to geographic locations where our data centers are actually placed. We've got 17 now, I believe. We just opened a couple new ones just last week to new regions in the United States. So we're up to 17 around the world, including we've got ones coming in Australia, Japan, China. We're the only public cloud operator in China at this point, Western Europe. And the list continues to grow. So as far as where they are, they're all over the place. And as far as each place where we're at, it's at least one physical data center, in many cases, several physical data centers. So tens of thousands of servers on the low end and hundreds of thousands of servers for some of the larger sites. The second one is their blueprint, and we do want to have a blueprint. Now, when you go into certain regions, it's not possible to go in and build a massive data center, which is what we're optimizing our blueprints for. For maximum efficiency, we want a very regular data center architecture that gives us lots of room for expansion. So in our major regions we go into, this is where we go in with blueprints. In some places, you've got to go in and based on access to power and water and other infrastructure facilities, we've got to make do with data center facilities that are already in place there, or make smaller versions that are off our mainline blueprint to accommodate the constraints that we've got to deal with.
Yeah, I would encourage everybody to go take a look at Scott Guthrie's keynote that he gave on Monday of this week at the Worldwide Partner Conference. He actually did a I really liked what he did. He kind of showed the size of a typical data center that we build for Azure, and he talked about in terms of you could fit two airplanes inside of each one of, you know, two 737s or 757s inside of each one of the components, and then there are like 16 of those inside of a single Azure data center. So, I mean, it's something like you could fit 32 Boeing airplanes inside of one of our data centers. I would really encourage people to go watch that. He also gave a couple of interesting statistics in terms of our footprint compared to other public providers. He compared us to both Amazon and to Google. And I apologize if I get the two numbers mixed up, but I think he said that we had five times the footprint, five times the locations, regions that Google does, and twice what Amazon does. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so in terms of different regions, different places where you can actually configure your data to be contained at, your applications to run, we have 2x the number of regions that Amazon has and 5x the numbers of Google.
Yeah. Now, we saw another question there about Gartner's Magic Quadrant, and it was that Gartner just announced the latest virtualization Magic Quadrant, and Microsoft is on that list. Are there other Magic Quadrants that relate to the cloud?
Yeah, that is a great question.
Well, I think we've talked in that video about PaaS and IaaS being we're the only public cloud provider in PaaS and IaaS Magic Quadrant. Now we're in the virtualization Magic Quadrant. We're also in the storage Magic Quadrant.
As a leader in all four,
right. And so we talked about how we were unique. We were the only ones in PaaS and IaaS. So just take that a step further. If you look at the mix of who we're with in the leader quadrant, none of them span more than two.
Yep.
And we're in all four. So
I don't think we can underemphasize just how important this is. Every single customer we talk to about the cloud never wants to feel that they're locked in, so they want to have that ability to be able to, you know, be running in the public cloud, but for whatever reason they need to pull back into a private cloud, they can do that. And I think the Gartner recognition of Microsoft as a leader in each of these four magic quadrants and the only organization, building on what Mark says, that is in two or more, I think just shows proof of our investments, our strategy to invest across the board and be best of breed and be a leader in storage, in private cloud, in IaaS in the public cloud, as well as in PaaS in the public cloud. That is the kind of flexibility, that's the kind of partner I think that you need to have, because you're not going to get locked in. You have unlimited flexibility with us.
So when we think about those areas that the cloud is showing up in as leaders, what are some, in terms of ways that people can take advantage of those things? We got a question here that asked, are there things I need to do in my data center to make it easier for a hybrid environment and a hybrid infrastructure? So what are some tweaks they can be making on premises to make that hybrid environment better?
Well, I'll start with one, and I know Brad's got some more. Great networking.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be hybrid, you're going to be talking to the cloud. And, you know, some of the scenarios that Brad talked about, a backup and DR, you want great pipes to get your data up into the cloud.
Yeah, I think the most challenging thing to get configured is how you effectively stretch your network from your private data center out into the public cloud. You know, so you want to bring your own IP address, so it's BYOIP. You want to be able to bring your own ranges. You know, you want, in many cases, you want to have a dedicated, secure, high-speed link that goes from your data center out to one of our data centers, and we announced at TechEd what we call Express Route. An Express Route allows you to to have a dedicated high-speed line directly from your data centers into ours. We've announced 16 or 17 different partners around the world that we enable this with. And one of the great things about it is you can just add this to your existing MPLS. Is that what it is? Your existing contract. It's nothing additional has to be done.
You know, unlike if you try to set something up similar to this with Amazon, it's a bunch of work that you have to go through. This can just be added on, and you get that dedicated high-speed link. And for those of you who are going to be pushing a lot of information or have a security concern, and you want to make sure that all communication that's going between your data centers and our data centers is on a committed, dedicated, secure line, ExpressRoute gives you a great way to do that. Now, going back to the first topic that I mentioned about stretching your network, that's one of the places we invested in heavily in Windows Server 2012 and then in 2012 R2. And so there's been a lot of work we did in networking there that allows you, to do it as about as simple as you can right now. And I'll say that there's always room for improvement, and it's one of those places where we'll just relentlessly try to simplify. But we built Windows Server 2012 R2 with one of the principal design points was the hybrid cloud. I mean, it was literally one of the five or six pillars that we communicated to the team that they were to focus on. And so I think we've made it as easy as possible to be able to set up your infrastructure so that then you have that ability to move VMs across clouds, have applications in the clouds that are taking advantage of data and of different pieces that are on-premises. So I think the magical combination is Windows Server 2012, System Center 2012, and then this, native Azure.
Brad, you mentioned Scott Guthrie's keynote from earlier this week.
Yeah.
A lot of people on the line know the Worldwide Partner Conference is going on right now.
Happening up.
Mm-hmm. In Washington, D.C. And
it was hot. It was hot there. Oh, my word, it was hot.
We got a question that says, in light of WPC, how can ISV partners work with Microsoft to help customers through the migration process?
Mm-hmm. How can they help?
Well, I think So as I think about the biggest challenge, and I can kind of, first of all, I can kind of compare it maybe to the Windows XP upgrade that the world just wrapped up with. The biggest issue that customers had as they were upgrading from Windows XP was compatibility with IE. So they had, a website, they had applications that had been built with a version of IE that shipped in Windows XP, and as they were moving up to 7 or to 8, they ran into compatibility issues. Right now, as I've been digging into the Windows Server 2003 base, asking, hey, what's the kind of, is there an equivalent of IE in the server base, I've not come across that yet. And what I've come across is organizations just haven't done enough of the migration and of the upgrade to really be comfortable about what they need to do. So in terms of ISVs, I think that there's a lot of work that can be done to just automate the process. So whether that be, automation scripts that are calling into the System Center Orchestrator, whether that's actually building tools that, give you this kind of a drag-and-drop experience. I guess the challenge of that would be, can you get that done in enough time to actually be able to capitalize that before the end of life, in July of next year. But I think the biggest thing that organizations need is they just need tools that help them automate the movement of 2003 to 2012 because, many of these organizations have got tens of thousands of OS instances and applications that need to be upgraded.
Yeah, and I think Brad's answer was about migrating from 2003 to 2012. There's another one about migrating from on-prem to the cloud, and that's one where we've got firsthand experience in some of the things that are required to do that. When we went to MSIT, said, let's figure out how to migrate you to the cloud. We need to do it, even if we don't necessarily need to do it from a business perspective right now. We need to push ourselves to do it so we can do it before other people are doing it and understand what's required and how to make it easy. And so one of the first things we did is said, what kind of apps do you have and how are they architected? Where is their data? How do their front ends communicate with the back ends? Which ones can, from a security compliance perspective, be up in the cloud first? Which ones from a risk perspective can be up in the cloud first? Which ones from a complexity perspective can we move first? And let's do that full inventory and categorize these things and then go start taking the low-hanging fruit. And there might be some apps that are low-hanging, but we're not going to invest in them anyway, so it's not worth moving. But that's kind of the first step that we took. And then it's a matter of developing patterns because they do tend to fit a few different patterns. And once you get down a playbook for migrating a certain pattern, then the rest become easier.
Yeah, and I'm going to kind of evolve on the question a little bit. Literally before walking into here, I finished up the blog that we're going to post early next week about the acquisition of InMage. So InMage is this organization. We referenced it in the video, and literally I just finished up the blog about 20 minutes ago on this. One of the things I just loved about this is InMage, as we got to know them and understood their technology, is they provide this beautiful disaster recovery solution where I can set up a relationship between an on-premises OS instance, whether it be physical, whether it be virtualized on either VMware or on Hyper-V, And I can then set that primary to synchronize with a secondary in a private cloud and a hosted cloud, and we'll be able to do that in Azure as well. The great thing about that is one of the things I learned throughout this process of working with InMaj is migration is just a subset of DR.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the tools that they have, they give you this wonderful DR solution you can also use from as a migration set of capabilities. And so I'd encourage everybody to take a look at the InMaj website, take a look at their capabilities, and think about how you can use this. And if I were to dive into technology, how it actually works, let's say that you're working in a VMware environment. As it's setting up that DR relationship, it actually is doing this migration of the VMDK, which is VMware's format, into VHD, whether that be on Hyper-V or whether that be into Azure. So it actually does that translation as a part of the process. You can set up DR, run on that for an environment, and then when you're ready to actually say that you're done and you want to move into a different cloud, you can just turn off the primary, and the secondary comes up, and you've migrated. You've migrated either to a Hyper-V environment or into an Azure.
So, Mark, you had mentioned about identifying some of the needs that your business has and, being able to have a strategy to migrate based on that. So as people are working with partners on that migration, what are some of the things that you would encourage all of these customers to ask or demand from their partners in terms of getting the best experience moving over and coming out the other side with, the optimally structured infrastructure?
Demands.
Maybe strong suggestions.
Strong suggestions. I think, we talked about identifying the architecture of your application. I think categorizing data and the affinity between compute and data is one, and making sure that classification leads to the right decisions about where that data is placed. I think one of the things that we've seen, like we've got our own architectural guidance group called the CAT team that works with customers and internal properties like MSIT,
yep.
And they will take a look at these architectures and that data classification and figure out, hey, we strongly suggest that you keep this data on-prem for now because that's where the database is going to be. We're going to migrate that last. You can put the front ends up in the cloud. So I think it's help in that architecture and that plan is critical. So it's not a take everything in one big bite kind of migration.
We're
putting a whole bunch of resources into our field right now to give this exact kind of guidance. It's hard to answer the question without understanding exactly what the architecture is, what the data needs are, those types of pieces. And so, one of the things that we could do is we should provide some kind of an email contact that customers have got, those kind of questions, they actually are ready to go start implementing. They could get some email into us, and then we could actually get them connected up with the field resources that are being
And we actually are. We recognize that a lot of people have these kinds of questions, so that the CAT team is specifically chartered now with putting up these kind of architectural guidance and patterns and steps on migration and building, and not just migration, but actually greenfield application development as well. On top of
that. So you know what? What we ought to do here is let's get an email address. Maybe Mark and I can both tweet this out a little bit later. But let's get an email address at organizations that are ready to actually move to Azure and are looking for this kind of guidance and help. They can send an email to this, and we can get them connected up with these resources that we have around the world right now. So let's make sure we get that done today.
So just to step back for a moment, Brad, you mentioned the InMaj acquisition that was mentioned in the video. You mentioned how that could also work with VMware.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, as we were building out what we call Site Recovery Manager, which is the automation on top of Hyper-V Replica that allows us to do DR, private to private, private to hosted, and private to Azure. The customers that are using this right now are absolutely loving it because it gives them a chance to provide a very effective disaster recovery solution at a fraction of what it would cost them to go out and build out the infrastructure on their own. One of the things that the world has always struggled with from a disaster recovery standpoint is the architecture, the hardware, the process, everything you had to put in place on premises to do that became prohibitively expensive because you basically had to put in gold-plated hardware, gold-plated processes to guarantee DR. Well, that sounds like that's the very kind of a problem we can solve through software, which is what we've done through the Site Recovery Manager. So it allows us to have you have your primary and then have the secondary running in another one of your data centers or in Azure or in a service provider, and we can automatically fail over or you can do a planned failover. But the beauty of it is the cost of it is a tiny fraction of what you would spend to build out that infrastructure on premises because we're using the cloud to do it. Now, as customers have been using this, and one of the great things about a service is we actually can see every week how many people are failing over, planned, unplanned, and it gives us a chance to actually interact a great deal with the customers that are using the service. The number one request we have from people who are using this is, we need this capability on VMware. Sure, VMware's got something called SRM, but it's incredibly complex to set up, and it's incredibly expensive. So Microsoft, give us a solution that covers more than just Hyper-V. Give us an ability to do that on VMware environments, and also give us the ability to do the same thing on physical environments. And, oh, yeah, do it on Windows and on Linux. That's what InMaj does. You know, it's one of these things where we had the request came in, we went out, and we knew we couldn't build this quick enough to be able to deliver on what customers wanted. So we went out searching in the industry who had this. And InMaj definitely just rose to the top because they give us this great DR solution for physical environments, for VMware environments, for Hyper-V environments, on Windows, on Linux. So literally, as we integrate this in now and we get this integrated in with what we're doing with the broader SRM across Microsoft, you'll have an ability to do DR to Azure or DR even between your own private clouds for every OS instance you have running on an x86 server. That's pretty darn cool, in my opinion.
That is. We have several questions that have been popping up here around security, things like having servers that are hosted by a third party, being in control of passwords, things like that. And depending on what industry you're in and how big your business is, you're going to have a lot of different security questions. So maybe you guys can start by talking a little bit about what are some of the security questions that you hear a lot that are the ones that people should not necessarily have to worry about, the things that we feel like we have solved or that we are really strongly addressing. What are some of those top two or three security concerns that you guys feel like have been really thoroughly addressed?
Well, I think one that we hear is a question around encryption and encryption at rest, encryption in flight in the data center and in the hybrid cloud scenario.
Where are the keys?
Yeah, where are the keys and is the data encrypted at all? And this is a place where I think there's a couple reasons why people ask about encryption. Like, let's take encryption at rest. Is they get some sense of security, like if it's encrypted at rest, then Microsoft doesn't have access to it, or a hacker that breaks into the data center doesn't have access to it, or somebody that walks into the facility doesn't have access to it. Or that's one category. And the other category is, of course, my business my industry requires compliance with certain certification that says data has to be encrypted at rest. Let's take that first category because I think that's a great place where I like to educate people about what the risks that they're trying to mitigate are and what how encryption can and cannot and may not play a role in mitigating those kinds of risks. Starting with, for example, if a hacker somehow penetrates the data center, they don't have access to my data. The fact is, if the keys are in the cloud, then a hacker, really have to assume that a hacker can get the keys and get access to the data. Now, of course, having the keys separate from the data, you could say that you make it harder for them to do it, but the fact is they can do it. The same goes for if Microsoft wanted to get access to the data, Microsoft could get access to the data.
Or the government
could get access to the data if the keys are there. Of course, Microsoft's gone on the record pretty vehemently and pretty publicly.
Just the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, just in the last couple of weeks. Brad Smith going to Washington. Is that we will do our best to keep our customers' data private that they want to keep.
Yeah, not only do our best, we will
do
fight the government any government request for data.
Yeah. Now, as far as hackers, for example, like I said, they can already get that. As far as somebody walking out of the data center with the disks, we've got several layers of security in our data center physical plants, from gates with guards with guns and fences and cameras just to get into the onto the grounds to
this sounds like one of your books.
Yeah, it does.
Is this a preview?
Yeah. Anyway, from clouds. But then there's the lobby, and there's you've got to prove that you've got a reason to be there on site and to get access into the data center facility with the hallways for itself, and then the server rooms are also protected with another layer, which is biometrics and locked doors that you've got to then, you have to have been authorized earlier to even get in. So we've got multiple, and we also have a very rigorous data destruction and sanitization protocols that make sure that there's no data that ever leaves our data center.
So as we retire the servers.
Yeah,
we
retire, destroy the disks, scrub them. So that we also take care of that. So what is encryption adding on to that with respect to physical security risk? And it's really not much, in my opinion.
And what I find really helpful is to kind of even walk through a step. Yeah. So let's use Store Simple, because that's been, I think, one of the best examples of how we actually leverage the Azure in a hybrid cloud environment. So the concept behind Store Simple, the value proposition, is we add the cloud as another tier of your storage. So we can take and put all your cold blocks of data up in the cloud. You get a bottomless file server, a bottomless data center in terms of storage. Now, the way this solution works is as files are saved and committed on-premises in your data centers, we dedupe the data, we encrypt it. It is then sent across the wire to Azure encrypted, and it remains encrypted. The keys never come out of your data center. So the physical location of the keys is in your data center. We dedupe and we encrypt the data before we send it. So it's encrypted at rest, it's encrypted in flight, it's encrypted in our data centers, and there's no way that anybody could ever get access to the data because the keys never leave your data center. That's kind of the architectural view that we're doing with backup, with disaster recovery, and start walking through all the different scenarios from a hybrid perspective. That's the model that we're following.
Now, that's for the people that really don't want to. You want to ensure that the data is never accessible.
Fair enough. And they're running as a SaaS app, all the pieces.
That's right.
Good point.
And the fact is, we understand that customers are going to be in that. A lot of customers are going to be, or some customers are going to be in that kind of profile of risk aversion to this, and maybe not for all their data, but some of it. The fact is, you're not really fully taking advantage of the cloud unless you're taking advantage of the compute aspect of the cloud. Being able to run massive jobs on that data that gets up in the cloud that you're producing from on-prem. I mean, it's bottomless storage, not just for your VM disks, but also for all the other data that your business is producing, the data that runs your business, right, that you really want to be able to throw big data analytics at it. And so for that, you're going to want to take advantage of compute in the cloud, and that means making that data readable up in the cloud. So if you're taking a perspective of I don't want any data to be in the clear in the cloud, you're really not, kind of crippling yourself when it comes to taking advantage of the cloud in a way that maybe your competitors aren't.
Yeah, good point. So we have time for one last question here, and I think both of you will have a lot to share about this one. It has to do with taking Active Directory to the cloud. So in particular, it asks, is the key to moving to on-premises to the cloud Azure Active Directory? And if so, can you tell me about any customers who are doing this and how it works?
Is the key Azure Active Directory? So the answer is yes. I think we've talked in the video about the identity being an anchor point for all activity in the cloud, whether hybrid or purely in the cloud. And the place that has really, where we see this entrenchment already beginning, or this leveraging of Azure Active Directory in the cloud, is Office 365, where Office 365 customers want to be able to use their enterprise identities to be able to access their Office 365 accounts, their mailboxes and their documents, and they don't want a separate password and login for those assets. They want to be able to leverage on-premises identities and have control over the life cycle of those identities. If an employee leaves the company, we want to be able to say no more access to Office 365 documents that you shouldn't have access to. And so by leveraging Azure Active Directory in federation with on-prem, their on-prem directory, or directory sync, we talked about that in a previous video about being able to use DirSync as another way to get those identities up in the cloud, they get this kind of control and this kind of single sign-on experience across Office 365 and their on-prem assets. And that Azure Active Directory, that same capability that Office 365 depends on, is exposed for SaaS apps to leverage as well, including all of Microsoft's first-party SaaS apps, other ones, but also third parties. There's SDKs that they can use to integrate with Azure Active Directory as well. So once you've got an enterprise that has an identity base that it's up in O365 and Azure Active Directory, other SaaS apps can now seamlessly integrate again to participate in that single sign-on experience and access control.
I posted a blog on this morning.
Yeah.
There's a blog I posted on this earlier in the week and then the one this morning as well. Every single SaaS app, every single cloud app that Microsoft is building will authenticate against Azure Active Directory. And in terms of, talking about a SaaS app that has hit escape velocity in the industry, that is Office 365. When 25% of all enterprise organizations worldwide are licensed for Office 365, I think the number I saw last week was 60% of the Fortune 500 have licensed it in the last 12 months. The numbers that we look at every single week in terms of the number of authentications that Azure Active Directory is doing are just mind-boggling when you're seeing, these billions of authentications that are occurring. It's an amazing service. And it's funny that the blog that I posted this morning talked about the fact that in many ways this move to the cloud kind of reminds me of kind of the pre
AD days, kind of like the old NT4 domain days, where you know you had to go create a separate user account across all these different domains, across all these different services. And now if organizations are going to embrace the cloud, you don't want to be in a world where you have to go create separate user accounts and maintain separate user accounts across the hundreds of SaaS apps that you're using. So one of the things in this enterprise mobility suite that we have allows us to extend your investments in Active Directory out to the cloud. In fact, we've done the integration now with more than 2,000 different SaaS apps to where the user account is automatically provisioned from AD to AAD and into the 2,000 SaaS apps, as well as the user gets this great single sign-on experience. And so the user comes in on their mobile device, whether that's Windows, iOS, or Android. They hit the first application. They're asked for their Active or Azure Active Directory credentials. After that, on that device, anytime they go to use one of these applications that are brought under management, it's automatically single sign-on like you're accustomed to on-premises for the last 15 years. So that's the enterprise mobility suite. I would just, you know, encourage you to go read the blog that I posted this morning, and there was one I can't remember if I did it on Monday or end of last week, but there's two blogs that talk about SaaS management and how Active Directory ties into that.
Well, gentlemen, thanks for taking the time for this webcast today, for the live Q&A, and for the last three, for that matter. Later on today, we'll post a link to the on-demand version of this to everyone who registered today. And thanks again for coming.
Well, thanks for having us. It's been great. Yeah.